Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a move against anti-Islam U.S. political activity. The U.S. makes a major announcement about activity in the South China Sea. Cybersecurity analysts express alarm with the spread of dorking.
Computer nerds have known for a while that it's amazing how much information you can find, how many things you can find out there that people probably think are private.
And Disney is having success with popular movies and a big new theme park in China. It's right ahead on The Voice of America. Several prominent religious figures held a joint news conference in Washington today to discuss standing shoulder to shoulder against bigotry on the campaign trail. Attending was correspondent Iftikhar Hussain of our Diwa service, and he joins me here in the studio. Welcome, Iftikhar.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Oh, thank you. I understand the officials want the Democratic and Republican parties to take a strong stand against anti-Muslim bigotry.
Yeah, this was the main purpose. I talked to people. I'm just coming from that event. It was at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. And by the way, it was a very crowded and inclusive event in terms of interfaith harmony in the United States. The reason they were there for the two important things, because of the campaign trail and the Islamophobia, the bigotry, they were trying to reach out to more and more people across America and put their message across that they reject bigotry, hatred, and choose hope and inclusiveness in America. And the second thing was that Daesh, the Islamic militant organization in Iraq and Syria, is becoming a more global threat. And we see a threat to a U.S. congressman just yesterday. So they were putting across the message that they reject extremism. They are more about the United States values to be part of the society, and they get across the message that this bigotry and anti-Islam remarks and somehow referring to the one of the U.S. Presidential candidate, Donald Trump, for some of his remarks, rejecting them, and want to be part of the political process and want to be very much American.
And did they specifically say what Trump said that they were opposed to?
They did not bring out any specific remarks or comments, but they were referring in general to the bigotry on the campaign trail. And some of the remarks, as a journalist we know, came from about Muslims not allowing them to the United States.
Right. Yeah, he wants to block the border
temporarily. Block the borders,
now.
Yeah. But they were sort of creating and building pressure. Since I spoke to Azhar Aziz, president of the Islamic Society of North America, who hosted this event, they are around 2 o'clock will be holding meeting with President Obama in the White House. He and his other colleagues and other interfaith leaders, they sort of creating and building a pressure and get their message across by holding this event that they reject this bigotry and they will not tolerate. They did not come up with the action plan, which we can say, but they were definitely against it, and they kind of signified that they will be out against such kind of bigotry.
Well, being a good correspondent, you were able to talk to some of the people there one-on-one.
Yes.
Who'd you meet?
There was Azhar Aziz, president of the Islamic Society of America. This he told me about this message, that what they want to put across. I touched on it briefly. And also the threat given to Congressman Ellison by the ISIS. He said that he totally rejected and Daesh has nothing to do with Islam. Again, Imam Magid, a very known religious scholar in Washington and in the United States, executive religious director of the Adam Center, he again spoke on the same issue to threats to Keith Ellison, congressman. He again rejected it and said, and he laughed and told me, is there my name on this list too? I said, I haven't seen the list, but I hope it's not there because for your role and for the role you play for the Muslims in the United States.
Well, I was reading the press release for this event, and there were certainly a lot of names and a lot of impressive people there.
Exactly. There were so many people. I have the list, and I can tell you that from which organization they come from, like former Archbishop of Washington, D.C., Director of the Religious Action Center for Reform Judaism, Fatima Salman, it's a Muslim community leader from Detroit, and President of the New Evangelical Partnership for the Common Good, and President of Interfaith Alliance. And there are so many. It was such an inclusive event as a journalist I have attended.
Okay, well, thank you very much for visiting our studio, Iftikhar, with that information. And we're being joined now here at the Anchor Desk by Andrew Palchevsky, our social media person. Welcome, Andrew. Have you met Iftikhar?
I haven't. Very nice to meet
you.
This
is Andrew.
Good to see you. Yeah, thank you.
And what's going on in social media today?
Well, it's interesting. As we're talking about this conference, people are using social media to kind of counter some of the bigotry that we've been seeing, a lot of it in the U.S. presidential campaign. Donald Trump supporters tend to be very vocal on social media and very vocal about some of these issues. And you're seeing groups like this really embracing social media and saying this can be a powerful tool to kind of fight back. They're taking that fight against bigotry to social media. So we are seeing that on social media. We're also seeing trending today, hashtag #FightFor15. Now, this is a campaign throughout the United States to get the minimum wage of $15 an hour, which people say is a living minimum wage. They say that the current minimum wage is too low and people can't support themselves. And so we're seeing rallies across the country and through social media, videos from those rallies, photos of people holding signs in St. Louis, Chicago, other cities throughout the United States. But that movement, similarly, using social media to push out and advocate for their position. I mean, the fact that hashtag #FightFor15 is one of the top trending hashtags in the U.S. right now shows that they've embraced this as a medium that to get their message out and that it's working for them.
Do you ever see any hate emails out there, tweets, hate tweets, or do they pretty much get rid of those pretty quick?
There's a very kind of gray area that social media have to deal with as far as hate speech. In a lot of cases, you know, if it's a terrorist organization, certainly like ISIS, they shut down those accounts very quickly. But then there's the issue, it kind of wades into free speech, and people say, oh, well, you're censoring speech. If I'm saying that, you know, a certain religion is, you know, terroristically affiliated, that's, you know, my right to say that. So people, you know, you do kind of have these back and forth arguments. I think more than anything, when people say those kind of comments, the collective, you know, social media sphere kind of targets them and tries to shut them down, and they have this kind of back and forth. So I think more than the companies themselves shutting down these tweets are the people using Twitter or Facebook or any of the other social media that kind of target those people and say, you're out of line, you're bigoted, and then the back and forth goes on and on.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
We all find ourselves in situations where we make a mistake, offend someone, and then find we owe them an apology. A new study published in the journal Negotiation and Conflict Management Research finds that there are six elements that make up an apology that's more likely to be accepted. Here's what they say you should do. First, acknowledge responsibility. Admit the mistake is your fault. Then offer to fix what is wrong in actions, not with words. Next, express regret, and then explain what went wrong. For the fifth element, declare your repentance. And last, request forgiveness. Lead author of the study, Roy Lewicki, at Ohio State University's Fisher College of Business, says apologies really do work, but you should try to include as many of the six elements as possible. But if you're in a hurry, Lewicki says that the first two elements, when you acknowledge responsibility and offer a repair, are most important to having your apology accepted. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The U.S. military has been conducting joint patrols in the South China Sea with the Philippines and is increasing its presence on the archipelago with rotational forces and equipment. U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter revealed that today. Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is traveling with the U.S. official in Manila and joins us on the line. Hi, Carla.
Hi, Susan.
Please tell us about this announcement today.
So very big news coming out of Manila today. Secretary Carter was announcing these joint patrols in the South China Sea as all of this controversy is going on with Chinese militarization of some of these reclaimed islands there. He said that the first joint patrol was carried out in March, and defense officials tell me that the second joint patrol with the U.S. and the Philippines was completed earlier this month. This is such a big deal because the Philippines is now just the second country after China, which the United States has conducted joint patrols in this sea.
Yesterday, you were talking about how they were designating China in this particular story. Were you surprised about how the Secretary of Defense spoke about it today?
This is much more aggressive than what we had heard before, but the Secretary wanted to make it clear to reporters that the United States is trying to tamp down the tensions there. He said, in fact, that this isn't in order to provoke anything. I don't know if China will see it the same way, but Secretary Carter was stressing that the entire need for this maritime increased security is because of Chinese behavior. In addition to these patrols, Secretary Carter announced with his Philippine counterpart that the United States is going to be having a rotational presence that stayed after these joint exercises that are going on now and concluding tomorrow in the Philippines. There's going to be about 200 airmen with about 9 or 10 aircraft that are going to be remaining near Manila. And in addition to these airmen, there are going to be about 75 Marines, primarily Marines, I should say, because some of them may not be Marines, that are going to be staying around Manila as well, working on command and control and helping to increase the infrastructure there for the command and control. This is big news because the United States wants to keep a rotational presence here in the Philippines, not a continuous one, Secretary Carter stressed, but one that is there enough to be a strong deterrent and a strong presence in the South China Sea area.
Any idea how long this rotational service will go on?
Well, this first rotational service, those 200 airmen with the aircraft, are going to be staying through the end of this month. It was not stated exactly how long the 75 primarily Marines who are working on command and control are going to be staying, but this is going to be something that will continue. So just when these airmen leave at the end of the month does not mean that no one's coming back. Someone will come back, not necessarily heel to toe, as they say in the military, one right after the other, but significant rotational forces that will be routine, I should say.
Remind us about what China is up to out there in the sea.
Well, China has been reclaiming over 1,000 hectares, I believe about 1,200 hectares of land in the South China Sea. There are a lot of disputed areas that not only China and the Philippines, but also Vietnam and Brunei claim in this area. So it's a very contested area. And so what China has been doing is building up on reefs, essentially. Sometimes it's not even an island or a reef, it's a cay. And they've been adding land to make it an island. In some of these, they've actually put different airstrips on and landed in Woody Island. They landed a jet on the island that they had built. Now we learn that they're building even closer to the Philippines. They're trying to build another airfield. And if they do so, the concern to the people here in the Philippines is that they may try to militarize those areas as well. And the Philippines do not want that to happen because they want to maintain their own sovereignty.
Well, thank you very much, Carla, for speaking with us today from Manila.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on International Edition, Dorking threatening your personal information, and Disney doing well in China. Hack attacks designed to probe critical U.S. infrastructure are nothing new, but cybersecurity analysts say they are becoming alarmed by the growth in a particular type of attack that computer nerds have quietly known about for years. It's called dorking, a search engine, as in Google dorking or Bing dorking, and it's a tactic long used by cybersecurity professionals who work to close security vulnerabilities. Now it appears the hackers know about it as well. International Edition's Doug Bernard covers cyber for us, and he occasionally comes in the studio here to scare us all. So, Doug, this does sound scary. What is this dorking thing?
Well, you know, no one better, I guess, to talk about dorking than me, perhaps.
No, so, you're not a dork.
So dorking is really a search technique that exploits really the core function of big search engines. These search engines are constantly going around, trawling around the internet, and basically looking to log and index, they call it, every computer, every port, every IP address it can find. It just gets that information and quietly stores it away. Now, most of that information is not really, you know, sort of publicly searchable. You really would have to dig around. There's just simply too much of it out there. But by using some very careful advanced search techniques, these search techniques that go really way back to the start of the internet, computer nerds have known for a while that it's amazing how much information you can find, how many things you can find out there that people probably think are private, but they just weren't hooked up right, and so now all that information is publicly available.
Give me some examples of
Sure, you bet. Well, here's a great example. In 2013, a small little upstate New York town opened a new sluice gate for their dam. Sluice gate is basically sort of a, you know, thing that allows
the
water down the spillway. Exactly. It was a $2 million, very modest. Local officials show up. Well, it turns out that they weren't the only ones that were interested. An Iranian hacker, a well-known hacker, broke in to that system basically by using this dorking technique. He just entered some search terms, some very specific nested search terms, and sure enough, when they hooked the sluice gate up, all of the sort of command and control structures was publicly available. It was there for anybody to find. He found it. Luckily, nothing happened, but you could imagine what could possibly happen.
Yeah. Well, I understand the Department of Justice is sounding the alarm over this.
Yeah, they did back in 2014. They announced, and this was unusual for them, they announced it, put out a public sort of warning saying that, look, you know, you really need to be careful about when you hook anything, I mean anything, up to the internet. You really need to make sure that it's configured carefully. And if you're not sure, ask somebody who knows. Because if you do something wrong, which chances are you will, that device, that information, you know, is going to be publicly available on all of these search engines. I tried it out. I just kind of tried poking around. It's a little like a scavenger hunt. But with a little patience and a little luck, I was amazed at what I was able to find. I mean, people's bank records, accounts, all kinds of really personal stuff that I'm sure they have no idea is out there.
Well, you succeeded in scaring us again, Doug.
Great.
<Thanks. laughs> Okay, thank you, Doug.
You bet.
This is VOA.
From Science and Technology, here's what's new.
What's new? Chariot for Women. It's a new ride-sharing service, just like the Uber taxi service, except, well, obviously, it's just for women. Female drivers, for female passengers. Leery about male drivers. Chariot for Women founder Michael Pellis is a former Uber driver.
I heard stories that were about unsafe travel and Uber drivers hitting on women.
Chariot for Women could not be just a safer ride service for women, but a job opportunity as well.
I've always thought about doing it, but the safety aspect of it was just kind of, I don't know who's going to get in my vehicle.
Chariot for Women is not the first of its kind. She Taxis, an all-female ride service, was launched in 2014, but had to temporarily shut down, partly because they couldn't meet demand. Chariot for Women will be active in the Boston area on April 19th. From VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossman.
Making money inside China can be difficult for Western firms, but one that is having a lot of success is Disney, with popular movies and a big new theme park. Matthew Pressburg follows entertainment business for International Business Times, and VOA's Jim Stevenson spoke with him about how Disney's Marvel films are a huge box office hit.
With the Marvel entertainment universe, that's been huge there. I mean, Disney's appetite for Marvel movies has really been astonishing. I mean, Avengers Age of Ultron made over $200 million there, and even Ant-Man, which is a very forgettable movie out here, was a $100 million movie in China.
Well, considering the production costs, China is a very lucrative market then for Disney.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Marvel universe has proven to play well there, and the animated movies do as well. Inside Out did quite well there, and Zootopia has really been the hit of the year. Zootopia has been in theaters it just got an extra 2-week run. So this thing is, you know, already the biggest animated movie ever in China, the biggest Disney movie ever in China, and it just keeps piling on those records.
Disney may have a little bit of an advantage because China only lets a certain number of Western films in each year, and of course they have to go through a censor board over there, mm-hmm. and the fantasy-type films probably are not as sensitive as some of the other movies.
That is true. I mean, Disney's movies are generally not the most controversial topic, which is kind of funny because Zootopia actually does have a social justice message, but it seems like the censors were okay with that. But for the most part, yes, it's superheroes, it's cute animals, it's the kind of stuff that, you know, the censors are not really going to look at too closely and are not going to, you know, raise a lot of controversy once playing in China.
Well, as far as the physical presence goes, we're all familiar with Disneyland and Disney World in the United States, and Disney has expanded worldwide into France, and of course Shanghai is the big destination now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's opening June 16th in Shanghai. It's going to be potentially the most visited Disney theme park ever. It's been in the process for about 15 years now, and so it's really been a long-time project. It's been a dream of Disney CEO Bob Iger. Really, since he took over the top job, he's been very focused on China. He's been out there multiple times a year, and, you know, so far, the project looks great. It was, you know, delayed. It was supposed to open the end of last year. It was pushed to the summer, but I haven't heard anything yet. It looks primed for the June 16th opening, and, you know, everybody I've said who's been there, who's seen the site, says it's, you know, the best one yet.
Things in China seem to move quite rapidly. A 15-year plan is a long time for a Chinese venture.
Oh, absolutely. And then, you know, there's been many different Chinese leaders and bureaucrats and everything. So, yeah, I mean, 15 years of that plan, it's quite a duration.
Compared to some of the other theme parks, I mean, what kind of attendance are they looking for comparatively?
I believe Tokyo Disneyland has about 17 million visitors a year, I want to say, and so they think they can beat that.
Being a country that invented fireworks, I'm sure they'll love the daily displays at Disney.
Absolutely. So I guess, you know, one other thing is that animation is the kind of thing that we could expect a lot more. Disney's kind of cracked the code on animation in China, Inside Out, Zootopia. And what we're seeing now is a lot of Chinese film companies are really keenly interested in starting animation departments, coming in and bringing in animators. And so Disney kind of showing the fact that animated movies can be huge hits in the Chinese box office may have actually influenced some Chinese film executives to dedicate more resources into that.
So we may see a Chinese version of perhaps the Japanese anime, where they create their own kind of cultural animation.
Absolutely. I mean, with the investment that they're making of that, that's absolutely something we could definitely see. I mean, anime.
Matthew Presberg with International Business Times. Thanks for joining us today for today's edition of International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
19 months ago, the violent extremist group Daesh, also known as ISIL, controlled about one-third of the territory of Iraq, and much the same in Syria. Supremely confident after their rapid conquest of these territories, ISIL trumpeted to the world its conviction that its fighters were unstoppable. Today it is clear that Daesh's days are numbered, said Secretary of State John Kerry during a recent press conference in Baghdad. In Iraq, Daesh fighters have not been on the offensive in months. They are losing ground, including more than 40% of the territory that they once controlled in Iraq, he said. Over the past year, Iraqi forces liberated Tikrit and most of the city's population has returned. Kurdish and Yazidi forces liberated Sinjar. Iraqi security forces retook Ramadi. And Syrian Democratic Forces have retaken thousands of square kilometers from Daesh in northeast Syria. The coalition bombing campaign has also seen great success, having cost Daesh tens of thousands of fighters and more than 100 senior and mid-level leaders, including their so-called ministers of war and finance. There is still much to do, but Daesh is clearly on the defensive. Today we are gearing up for recovery. Before displaced Iraqi civilians can return home, significant work needs to be done to stabilize areas that encountered significant levels of destruction due to Daesh's occupation and the fight required to liberate these areas. For that reason, the United States has joined other members of the coalition to contribute a total of over $100 million to the United Nations funding facility for immediate stabilization. The program, led jointly by the UN Development Program and the government of Iraq, helped over 100,000 Iraqis return to their homes in Tikrit. Now it is working to do the same in Ramadi through restoring public services so people can return to their homes. Since the beginning of the crisis, the United States has provided more than $623 million in humanitarian aid to Iraqi refugees. And in Baghdad, Secretary Kerry announced an additional $155 million for Iraqis affected by the ongoing violence. Our support for the Iraqi people, said Secretary of State Kerry, is part of our larger commitment to a future Iraq as defined in its constitution, an Iraq that is unified, pluralistic, federal, and democratic.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage.